Well, this is Ariel Street, which is off Malvern Street in the Shankill Road, which is significant for a number of reasons. But Ariel Street, you'll see it, it's just a plain Belfast mill street with a pub at the corner. But 50 yards from here, just up that street, was Ariel Taxis, where the taxi, one of the vehicles used in the Dublin-Monaghan bombs, was hijacked from.
We're standing at Loyalist's Corner in Belfast with veteran journalist Hugh Jordan.
This is where it started its journey, in this very street, to pick up a bomb and then take it to South Leinster Street in Dublin, yeah.
It's here the first of the four cars involved on May 17th, 1974 originated, as a well-orchestrated plan to bomb Dublin and Monaghan swung into gear.
I mean, if you think historically, where that is listed in the terms of atrocities, terrorist atrocities on the island of Ireland, it is truly significant what happened in this street. The planning that went into Dublin-Monaghan was massive. It really was. Now, I know terrorist organisations, and I've discussed this with them, but at that time, with the tension in Northern Ireland, we were 3 days into the Loyalist strike against the power-sharing Sunningdale Agreement, which offered Catholics a role in power-sharing. I think that was the UVF's answer, was to bomb Dublin and Monaghan. Now, it was a huge undertaking logistically, an awful lot of cars, bombs, preparation of bombs, where to prime them and where to set them on the road, and then how to get out, how to get away from Dublin.
Early morning, May 17th. Two cars hijacked and another stolen in Belfast by members of the Ulster Volunteer Force. The gang headed south out of the city, delivering the vehicles to the bombers at an isolated farmhouse near Glenann in South Armagh.
They knew very quickly that the cars that had been hijacked or stolen, that they all came from Loyalist districts of Belfast. So there was no doubt in their minds that it was Loyalists who had procured the cars and come south and planted the bombs. So there couldn't have been any doubt about that.
Margaret Irwin is coordinator of Justice for the Forgotten, a campaign group for victims of the atrocity.
Well, they weren't afraid that they would be caught. They didn't even replace the registration plates. They were the original registration plates. Those who stole the car obviously believed that wouldn't be noticed until evening, perhaps. But it didn't make any difference anyway, because they all got through to Dublin.
The name Frenchy Marchant crops up in relation to the cars. He was a senior guy in the UVF in West Belfast. So Marchant was given the task of stealing a number of cars. He was a powerfully built man, and he held a senior position, was involved in a lot of UVF activity, particularly bombings, and he coordinated the stealing of the cars, which eventually left Belfast en route to Portadown and then Glenann.
Outside Glenann, there is a farmhouse which was owned at the time by an RUC man called James Mitchell.
Anne Cadwallader has investigated the links between Loyalist paramilitaries and security force personnel such as James Mitchell.
We do believe that that was an area that the bombs used in Dublin-Monaghan were stored. But certainly Glenann, the farmhouse outside Glenann belonging to James Mitchell, was certainly very critical to the whole operation.
Mitchell's farm in Glenann is quite a remarkable place. It sat on its own, and the road into it is from an elevated position, so you can see it. And it has a kind of panoramic view of the surrounding area. So it's quite a good place to run a terrorist organisation from. So the fact that his place became the epicentre of the Mid-Ulster UVF and the Glenan, what became known as the Glenan Gang, which was a loose mixture of RUC members, British Army members, and the Mid-Ulster UVF, and the sort of nub and magnet that held it all together was the farm, Mitchell's farm at Glenan.
The Glenan Gang is linked with 120 murders, including Dublin Monaghan.
One of the key figures was Robin Jackson. He was a paid police agent and a multiple psychotic killer, sectarian killer, who was responsible for a huge number of killings. Nobody really knows how many, between 20 and 30, maybe more. But he was also a police agent. Another one was were the brothers, Wesley and John Somerville, who were based in Mogashal. They were key figures. And there were others in Portadown as well. People who were, some of them, of whom are still alive, but as to my knowledge, have never confessed or never admitted their role, and probably never will.
The Dublin cars were primed near the airport before converging on the capital. But given the complexity of the operation and the casual disregard for being caught, could the bombers really have acted alone?
Collusion is a crime that involves a subterfuge, a collaboration between members of the security forces and loyalist paramilitaries. But one half of that relationship are the police or the army or the intelligence services. And they're the people tasked with solving crime. They're the people who are in control of the evidence. And they're hardly likely to be coming to the marketplace and holding their hands up. So the difficulty with collusion, proving it, is that the evidence is all there somewhere in the files, locked away or in people's heads. But getting to it is the problem.
In the south of England, there's a man who knows a lot about what happened in May 1974.
Yes, I quite often briefed senior figures who were visiting. I travelled around with Edward Heath when he came round. I also travelled around with Harold Wilson when he came round, briefed him for the press conference.
Colin Wallace was Senior Information Officer at British Army Headquarters in Northern Ireland between 1972 and 75.
I think in terms of paramilitaries as a whole, the level of intelligence by 1974 was very, very good because it was cumulative. And you see, at ground level where you have, say, a company of soldiers, they gather a huge amount of information about everything within their patch. That then moves up the system.
Those involved in the atrocity were not only well known to British intelligence services, some were paid informers.
But then we realised also that these individuals as well, while they may not be killing soldiers, were actually creating mayhem. Some of them we knew were interacting very closely with the security forces, either the RUC or with ourselves. Some of them clearly were talking to us for various reasons. The main people involved in the planning and organising were certainly very well known to us. And I think one of the difficulties that we have now looking back on that is that it's now a well-known fact, not coming from intelligence, that some army officers were frequently socialising with some of those people. And their names have been published in the press repeatedly.
But the UVF and the Protestant paramilitary groups, there was a sense that the intelligence controlled them at the time.
Not at the time when I arrived. Eventually I found out they were controlling some of them. And in the end, by the time I left, shortly afterwards, I found out they were controlling the whole bloody business.
Fred Holroyd is a former British Army captain and intelligence officer who served in Northern Ireland from January 1974 until May 1975.
But we used him first to do things, and we used him first by telling him lies. So they believed somebody was their enemy who wasn't at all, who didn't even know what the hell was happening. And I wasn't in that game. That wasn't my game. I didn't understand that for a start. I went in there like a baby, I hadn't a clue, you know, and I thought the British Army was the best thing since sliced bread and didn't do things like that and everything else. And gradually, as the time goes through and I'm getting more and more competent, I'm seeing more and more of this.
The Dublin bombs involved sophisticated timing devices. They contained 400 pounds of explosives and detonated with maximum efficiency. They were unlike anything loyalist paramilitaries used either before or even after. Indeed, one of the Dublin gang, Harris Boyle, was killed by his own device at the Miami Showband massacre just a year later.
Now, the loyalists at that point had never, to the best of our knowledge, done that. And that was very interesting because the loyalist bombs were basic. The ones used in Dublin were very sophisticated. So suddenly you had this bombing incident, which was very, very well done, and the mixture was good, everything was right, and then later the quality went down, as you rightly say. How can you justify that? There's a question mark there. I can't answer that, and I'm not sure that anybody other than those involved can answer it, but it has to be dealt with, I think.
The sophistication really is in the short term that they had to steal the cars, transport them to Dublin. They were stolen, I believe, in Belfast. They had to be transported then somewhere to Dublin.
James Donovan is a former chief forensic scientist for an Garda Síochána. He examined some of the debris from Dublin.
It did take sophistication to assemble the device fairly quickly and effectively, obviously, since it detonated. It would take a fair amount of experience of that, and very few people would have that experience, even within an army, for example. If the loyalists got help from professionals, there would be very few professionals that would be in a position to do, to help them, because the army does not set up bombs like that themselves. It took some experience and some knowledge to be involved at all. And the sheer mechanism of geography, of coming to a different jurisdiction. There are a lot of problems with working out what happened or could have happened. And I mean, obviously, the simplest thing would be that it was loyalist with some advice maybe from somebody professionally qualified to do that.
And there's always been speculation about where the bombs came from.
Well, simplistic, I would have to admit, it was extremely efficient and effective, and it was more efficient and effective than normal. Bearing in mind the scale, the logistics was huge. The explosives used were largely a mixture, and I give evidence to one of the inquiries in Dublin in the past in the belief that the explosive was homemade, and it was actually originally of IRA manufacture. And therefore, how did they acquire that? Either they managed to get some captured IRA material, or some of the material that was captured was given back to the loyalists. The question is, it had to have been taken from, and it must have been willingly, otherwise it was stolen, from stores where that material was actually captured. And that is quite a sobering thought, if that's true.
The RUC quickly had good intel on suspects for Dublin Monaghan and their links to security personnel. According to Colin Wallace, so too did British intelligence services.
I had a list of suspects by, I would think, within 3-4 days of the people we believed were involved, and that was a fairly comprehensive list. But we had a fairly good idea of what happened. I think probably the names that we had were accurate because we had good connections. Some of them were very well known, very active terrorists, and they continued that career for quite some time after 1974. I don't have any doubt at all that in the lead-up to the Dublin bombings, that we had sufficient context to have a very good picture that something was being planned, at the very least. And I am certain in my own mind, from the context we had, that we would have known what the target was. Whether we knew the precise date or not, questionable, but again, on balance, I think we probably would have.
Could it have been prevented, therefore?
That's a difficult question. In theory, yes, but quite often people come back and say, well, for various good reasons, or in, for the greater result, nothing was done about it.
A year after the atrocity, Colin Wallace wrote a letter to MI6 naming 8 of the bomb suspects and stating his belief loyalist violence was caused by intelligence stirring up conflict. Nothing happened, bar a campaign to undermine Wallace. The RUC's list of suspects also amounted to naught. It failed to mount a full murder investigation, despite much of the plotting happening in its jurisdiction. And so it was down to An Garda Síochána.
I mean, they had all these suspects and nobody was even questioned. They weren't arrested, they weren't questioned, yet they had all these names.
But the Garda's investigation was fatally flawed, as Margaret Irwin explains.
They had people picked out of photo albums. One of the Gardaí, based up in Monaghan at the time, I think, and he got all these mug shots of loyalist suspects. He put them into albums and people picked them out of the albums. And there was the driver of the Parnell Street car, for example, 3 different eyewitnesses picked out the same photographs of this guy. He was never questioned.
Gardaí initially conducted a nationwide raid on Republican homes and premises, despite early evidence already pointing towards loyalist paramilitaries. They also targeted some of those caught up in the massacre, including then 15-year-old apprentice tailor Noel Hegarty.
When I came out from hospital, I was only home a couple of days, and 2 detectives came to the house, and my father answered the door and spoke to them. So they wanted to interview me in the front room of the house on my own, and they asked my father would he mind waiting outside, and they didn't interview me, they interrogated me. Why was I there? What was I doing there? Who was I with? Where were you going? You know, like, I never got an apology from them for treating me in that manner, as though I had done something wrong. You know, that just added to the problems. You know, I was already in a daze, already befuddled, and then to made feel as though I planted the bomb or I had set it off. That's how they made me feel. It seemed like a long time. It probably was only maybe 20 minutes, half an hour, but it seemed a lot longer. You know, that played on my mind for years. You know, when I'd see a policeman or a guard or anything, just made you feel guilty all the time. I already felt guilty as it was. Don't know why.
Several potential leads weren't chased at all.
Nobody ever asked us. This is the first time anybody ever asked me about the bomb in Monaghan. First time.
On the evening of May 17th, 16-year-old Mary was working in Heaton's in Monaghan town, dressing storefront windows within views of Greeson's pub across the street where the bomb went off. Potentially a key eyewitness. Her recollection is shared here for the first time in 50 years.
Sometime in the afternoon, was different cars pulled in and out, you know, outside the shop. But we did remark, all right, you know, I do remember cars parking, and I do remember that car parking outside the shop. That car being the car that, as far as we're concerned, that the bomb was in. That car was parked outside the shop, and I do remember people getting out of that car, fellas getting out of that car, and I do remember one of the fellas had hair, shoulder-length hair and a beard. I can still see that person getting out of the car. I do remember an elderly man, after they left, that's what drew my attention to it, was this elderly man lay up against the car, and I was thinking, if these fellas come back, they won't be happy to see this man lying up against the back of their car. And nobody ever followed up on that, no. You know, nobody come near us, nobody would have, maybe because we were underage, nobody would have, you know, our evidence or anything like that would never have, you know, stood up or anything like that. I don't know why, but nobody ever asked us. This is the first time anybody ever asked me about the bomb in Monaghan.
And when the RUC told Gardaí they'd arrested some of the bomb suspects, Gardaí never asked who they were. Flaws also extended to mismanagement of forensics of the bomb debris.
In terms of the forensics, they were not stored properly. They were put into plastic. What was gathered was put into plastic bags, and they should have been stored in nylon bags. They should have been taken to the forensic science laboratory immediately or within 6 hours. And it seems they were not taken until the 28th of May. They were sent to the Northern Ireland Forensic Science Laboratory, and the report that came back from a scientist called R.A. Hall stated that he should have got the debris within a few hours for him to be able to do a proper analysis of it. And of course then it went missing. Nobody knew where the actual exhibits were. There was no chain of custody for the debris. Well, some of the debris was given ad hoc to Dr. James Donovan.
I heard that the bombs had gone off because it was a Friday evening. But on the Monday morning, I think it was Monday, Ted Jones, a Garda sergeant in the Technical Bureau on the scenes of crimes, he arrived in with debris from the Parnell Street bomb. Now, I did some work on that and found some material relevant to an explosive. But equally, he came in a week later then with some other bits and pieces from the scene. I was not aware of any other trace evidence required in other bombs. Nobody told me where they went to.
When did you find out where they had gone?
At least 20 years and more than 20 years afterwards. I was just a bit disappointed insofar as if you've just one bomb or the debris from one bomb, then that is a single entity. Whereas if you had the three bombs and the fourth one in Monaghan, it would be a useful technique of comparing and cross-referencing what you found. But that didn't happen.
Dr. James Donovan didn't receive any material until 3 days after the bombing. His analysis, too, was fatally compromised.
One of the things you would always look for would be diesel oil, flammable substances, petrol. That would be dried away by 3 days anyway, so depending on how it's kept. If the material had come more quickly, I could have started working on it earlier. But it's generally felt that the quicker the analysis is done, the less loss there is.
Did Gardaí have the expertise at the time to help in a forensic investigation of a bomb scene such as this?
Well, we didn't have many bomb scenes to investigate. It was difficult to understand if they sent one bomb debris to me from Parnell Street. Why did they go elsewhere? Speed is really well of the essence there. You're still left with a feeling that not enough calmness was introduced with police either.
Despite all this, Gardaí still quickly identified how the bombings were executed and who the main suspects were. Their list largely tallied with both those of the RUC and Colin Wallace, but nothing happened.
The Garda investigation was wound down within weeks. The Monaghan investigation was, for all intents and purposes, complete by early July of 74, and Dublin was all over by August. So, you know, you had such a short time for a terrible instance of mass murder.
But why was the biggest murder hunt in the history of An Garda Síochána Síochána over within weeks? And how were bereaved and survivors to get the answers they so desperately wanted?
Bertie Ahern, former TD in Dublin Central and former Taoiseach. I had found out, I think the previous year, the records were a sad story, a file or two with nothing in them. That I didn't know at that time. I don't think it was ever public, because I should have known about it if it was. But I didn't know until I read this file, if I can call it a file. But that was the first real shock of the whole thing, that this special investigation to the biggest event that had happened in the South, in the Troubles, set up in the aftermath of the bombing in 74. 34 people died, 300 people registered injured, far more, that the inquiry closed down weeks later.